you know, I started to kind of push back. The passion I had for law enforcement grew, and that's sort of what got me in trouble.
Okay.
You know, I start saying, wait a minute, we're not going to work all these hours, and I'm going to have something to say about it.
Welcome to the Off Duty Podcast, the podcast where we interview the men and women of law enforcement and help you to learn about the person behind the badge. If this is your first time tuning in, thank you. My name is Anthony McNeil, retired police officer and your host. Let's get started.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Off Duty Podcast, episode number 127. Once again, it's me, your boy, Anthony McNeil, back with another fantastic guest joining me here on the podcast. This gentleman spent 22 years in law enforcement. He's originally from the state of California. He's an author. He's one of three, I believe, founders of an organization that I find to be tremendously incredible. And I'm going to get into that with him in a second. It's something called The Humble Kitchen. And when I came across this and I saw this, man, was I impressed with what these gentlemen are doing. I'm happy to have joining me here on this episode, Mr. Ramsey Jackson. Ramsey, how you doing, sir?
I'm great. It's great to be here. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, man. Listen, y'all don't know the headaches I've been having this morning with this technology side, but it sounds like we finally got it together. So hopefully everything goes smoothly here. Ramsey and everybody, if you guys have listened to the podcast before, you know how I like to start each and every episode off. And that's simply why law enforcement, man.
You know, funny question. I was a black kid in the ghetto. And, you know, we look at cops a little different. Like, we should throw rocks at them and then run. And then as I got older, when I was in college, they would come for the career day. And I thought, man, who would go to college and then be a cop? That's ridiculous. I'm not doing that. I'm going to graduate and get $1 million. I'm not going to be a cop. And so I sort of had a series of accidental jobs where I worked at a group home, and that led me to juvenile hall. And then that led me to greater probation. And then one day they had advertised a job in the probation department. And I thought, well, while I'm on this computer, let me see what else they have. Mm-hmm. And they were advertising for deputy sheriff. And I thought, oh, that's the dudes that stand at the metal detector. I could do that. They make more money. I'm gonna just do that. And then I went to the academy and I thought, wait, no, these teach me how to pull people over. I just want to stand at the metal detector. I don't want to do no work. Wait a minute. And so at each juncture, I got comfortable. I started to work, you know, sheriff's office. We do custody and courts and whatnot. So I went to the jail and I thought, okay, I'm comfortable here. Then I went to patrol and I thought, oh, this is, you could help people. You could chase down bad guys. You could do all kind of stuff. And then, I had a great career. I went to, investigations. I did undercover work. It was a blast.
Once you got into the profession, was it what you thought it would be?
Parts. And it's an interesting question because a lot of us look at it and think, oh, I want to be a TV cop. I want to get shot in the arm. I want to cuss out my captain and I want to solve all the cases off duty. And it's like, that's not a thing. But also that component of being in the community, participating in the community and being able to sort of shape at least your beat. You know, if you're there long enough, you can guide your own career. You know, that camaraderie was there, for a while. So there were definitely some things that were appropriate and some things that I thought, wow, this is not what I expected at all.
Yeah. I think for a lot of us, you know, when we go into the profession, we have that same thought that, you know, this is going to be like TV. Yeah. We're going to be running and gunning 24/7.
Oh, yeah.
But nah.
Paperwork? What? Reports? I thought you could shot up stuff and then just, that was it. You just went home. Reports.
Had you not gone into law enforcement, what do you think you would have ended up doing?
Well, I went to college originally on pre-med.
Okay.
So I thought, I'll be a physician or I'll be a psychiatrist. And then I decided, oh, well, you know what? I like literature. So I'm going to write. So I tried to do that for a while. And then you don't make no money. If you don't have a safety net, you need a job.
Yeah.
And as you get older, you know, you need benefits. I need insurance. So. Yeah, I think I would have been an author. I mean, I don't know. I would have dabbled in some sports or something like that. But
yeah. Yeah. When you got started in the profession, Was there an aspect of the job that was a little harder for you to adjust to?
I got eased in. Like a lot of guys, they come out of college or out of the military or whatever, and they go right to the police academy. Well, yeah. I worked at juvenile hall, man. So it's a bunch of kids. So they're a lot easier to deal with. There's some heartbreaking stories, but they're kids. Yeah. So learning how to do custody there. And then when I went to the sheriff's office, I'd been there 6 years. So I'd already known how to do the custody aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was a lot easier for me to sort of ease in than a lot of other people.
Yeah. I think for me, when I started, man, I started in 92. And okay. I think the moment that the job became real for me was on my first traffic stop. I'll never forget it because, it was my first day in the FTO program. And my FTO, we stopped this car, and the guy that we stopped is about 6'4", probably about 350, 375. And I remember sitting in the car, and, you know, I think, oh boy, he had probably 42 suspensions or something like that.
Damn. Yeah, I get that.
So we're sitting in the car, and my FTO says, whatever you do, don't piss this guy off, because we're going to have to lock him up. You know, I was like, well, I don't know how that's going to go. I mean, if we have to fight this dude, it's going to be a handful.
Oh, yeah. You know?
And I remember getting out of the car and having to go up and tell this guy to put his hands behind his back. And he looked at me like, fuck you. And that's and that's when it hit me. I'm like, what am I getting into?
Oh, yeah. Just that little badge does not change everybody's attitude.
Yeah.
Not for the better anyway. Not for the better.
Dang. That's for sure. Now, you spent 22 years in the profession, and mm-hmm. you recently left the job, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you just lose the passion for it, or was it just time to go?
No. It was time to go, but that was not my decision. That was their decision. Yeah. Okay. I got a greater passion, I think. Like when I was younger, I came in and I thought, let me just toe this line. Like I just want to, what are we all doing? Let me just do that.
Yeah.
And then you look up and you realize, well, wait a minute. Some of these people and some of these policies and some of this administrative work is counter intuitive to the community itself. So it's like, all right, well, I'm going to speak up on that behalf. And that kind of burned some bridges to me. And then as I got older and deeper in the profession, I realized some of these policies are counterintuitive to us as law enforcement professionals, where you're asking us to work overtime, indefinitely, mandatory, when you could, you know, change how the policies are run and how the scheduling is set up. Mm-hmm. You're asking us to separate ourselves based on class and familiarity and a bunch of other things. And so I started to kind of push back. So the passion I had for law enforcement grew, and that's sort of what got me in trouble.
Okay.
You know, I start saying, wait a minute, we're not going to work all these hours and I'm going to have something to say about it. Well, mm-hmm. wait a minute. You're not going to marginalize all these people here just because they're deputies or, you know, professional staff. And I have something to say about it. You know, wait a minute. I'm going to start a black union, and it's not about rah, rah. We don't like anybody else. It's about whatever happened to generational wealth, whatever happened to emotional intelligence, whatever happened to the things that we don't have as a culture access to. Right. And so that got me in trouble. And then at the very end, it was like, listen, I'm going to promote. And they thought, no, you're not. We will figure out a reason and we'll let you go. And that's what happened.
Wow. Yeah, man, that's one of the tough things about the department or about the profession.
Sure.
You know, if you get into certain departments, you got to learn to play the politics and all that crap. And
yeah.
I was kind of like you. I kind of went against the grain a little bit.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I got myself in trouble from time to time with my mouth. But, you know, it was what it was. And if something wasn't fair, it wasn't fair.
Right.
And I had this one asshole supervisor that to this day I can't stand. And
yeah, of course.
And, you know, he and I got into it a few times, and I never promoted. And, you know, I had other reasons why I never tested to promote or anything like that. And that was
sure.
a large part of because I had, you know, I had my own business at the time that I was running, and I didn't want to have to be responsible for nobody else. I had enough that I was already responsible for. But, yeah, you know. in the job, you know, we get into our cliques and we develop that us against them mentality, and that herd mentality a lot. And when an individual steps up, you know, they're usually outcasted, and that's not a good thing. You know, we don't all have to be the same.
Very much so. You know, interestingly enough, there are people at the sheriff's office. It's not like a municipality, right? You can work in the jail and then you can work on the street, and the street guys are supposedly smarter, tip of the sword, spear, you know, better cops. And even when I was there, I thought, man, you don't want to do the real work. I would think about the guys in custody, realize everybody's not there for that. Some people are there because they got kids.
Yeah.
And they need health insurance and a good job. That I don't want to go save the whole world.
Right.
And that's okay. I mean, they're great at their capacity.
Right.
They just weren't the same as me, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Outside of law enforcement, what else you enjoy doing?
Oh my God. I mean, I'm California, so the beach. I try to stay active, right? Ride your bike, go to the beach, surf a little bit. We do, like you had alluded to, we do the Humble Kitchen, which is essentially just a pop-up dinner series. That what I learned, you know, basically working in law enforcement is that you can help the community as long as you have a platform. But if your agency takes that platform away, then you no longer have access.
Yeah.
So we develop Humble Kitchen to still participate in the community. And I think the rewards of that they're better for us than they are for the nonprofits and the charities that we connect with. It's a great feeling, you know, to be able to set that off.
Yeah. Now, speaking of Humble Kitchen, man, just so you, the listener, know, Ransom reached out to me and, you know, he asked to come on the podcast, and I started doing some, Ramsey.
It's all good. I'll hold anything for ransom. Whatever. If you're going to pay me, I'm cool with that.
Ramsey, look, you know, he reached out to me and asked about coming on the podcast, and I try to do a little research on each guest before, you know, before I get on the mic with them. And man, I have to be honest with you. When I looked at what you guys were doing with the Humble Kitchen, I don't know if anybody's ever told you this before, but you guys have something there. You guys have a TV show in the making.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Sort of. Go ahead.
Well, the chemistry between you and your two partners, the mission that you guys are setting out to accomplish, it all just goes together. The other two gentlemen, I forgot, one's the chef and...
Yeah.
Is it Jimmy and
Eddie? Yeah. Eddie does the chef work, and then Jimmy is a restaurant manager, so he usually sets up sort of the atmosphere and the ambiance and whatnot in there.
But just the connection and the chemistry between the three of you, man, the jokes, the laughing, and everything that you guys are doing. When I saw it, I'm like, I wonder if they realize they have a TV show here in the making. Because I don't know if you guys ever looked at it that way, but I've seen some garbage put on TV before.
For sure.
And yeah. This is way above any of that nonsense.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. And I love what you guys doing. You touched on it a little bit, but can you just talk about more in depth what the Humble Kitchen is and everything?
Yeah. So essentially where we're at is we do gourmet pop-up dinner. So we'll take an atmosphere in any area, right? We've been traveling for a while. COVID sort of put the brakes on that. I mean, obviously like everybody else, but you travel around to these different areas, find a venue, whatever kind of venue it is, sort of set that venue up in like a really nice scene. We've done gyms. We've done outdoor in the field. We've done, you know, a lot of different things. And then we provide a gourmet meal.
Okay.
Then we pre-sell tickets, right? And part of the money from those ticket sales go directly to whatever nonprofit that we are showcasing in that community, right? So let's say we do, let's just say we do a YMCA. Well, we invite two representatives from that place. They can come out and at the dinner, they give their spiel. Hey, this is us. Can you guys donate? Do you want to be a member? Yada, yada, yada. So we give them that platform. We film all of it. We put it on YouTube, right? And the idea is, part of the sick ticket sales go there. Hopefully they can generate interest. They get an opportunity to sort of network at this dinner with people who want to participate or connect with them, or, you know, they get something out of that. Mm-hmm. And then when you watch the shows, you think, oh man, I could connect with this charity. So it gives them a third arm to be able to generate what they need in the community. So what we're trying to do is to, obviously we want to showcase Eddie and have some fun and talk crazy to each other. Cause it's great. I mean, we've been friends since probably 10th grade.
Okay.
So, you know, Jim's in Oregon, Eddie's in Utah, and I'm in California. So the opportunity to get together to do things, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And so then we get to generate, you know, we get to participate in the communities and sort of make them better. Like I don't have a nonprofit like that, but I get to showcase them. You know, I get to connect people to them. So it's a good feeling for us.
How do you guys select the nonprofits that you choose to help?
A lot of different ways. So we, you know, obviously everybody's got friends, right? And your friend will come, hey, I know this nonprofit. They're great. I know the president of it. Hook up with them. So we'll take advice from folks. Some of it's just research. You'd be amazed at how many nonprofits we had offered. Essentially, all you got to do is show up, eat a meal, tell your story, collect stuff. That's it. Like you don't have to try, you know, what, and how many of them were like, nah, we're not really interested in that. I'm like, you don't want a free gourmet dinner.
Right.
And some money. Like what are you doing? You know? So, we try to research and we try to do things that we feel, you know, compelled to participate in. We've done a lot of work with battered women, sex trafficking, veterans, you know, real estate, that type of thing. So, once we have, let's say we have three or four different nonprofits to select from, we sort of powwow and figure out which one we think needs the most exposure, which one we feel closest to, and which one we feel is like necessary. And sometimes you get two of them and you go, look, we'll swing back. We'll do another one for you. You're too good to miss out on.
Yeah. Now who's invited to the dinners? Are they representatives of the nonprofit? Is it the community or who's all invited?
Yeah, usually. So we put out ticket sales early, maybe a month in advance, and it's whoever wants to show up. A lot of times it's the nonprofit because they have people that support them that want to come. It's the venue provider. They have people that want to showcase their venue. So they invite people. It's us. You can find us, on our social media. Is that all right?
Sure.
Yeah. We're at Humble Kitchen 2019 on Instagram and then Humble North America on Instagram. And then on our website is humblenorthamerica.com. And so we advertise wherever we can advertise and whoever wants to eat a good meal, come on out.
Yeah. Speaking of good meals, the food looks delicious.
It's good. It's great.
Food looks fantastic, man. I'm like, holy shoot. I may have to get me a ticket because the food looked fantastic. How long you guys been doing this?
2019.
Okay.
So a few years, but then like I say, I moved over this past year in 2022. We had a lot of things go on with us. So we only did maybe one or two events during the year. Just life shifting. COVID, it made us pivot. We had to do a lot of different things. People didn't want to come out. And California was very, very restrictive on what you could do with food during that time. And so what we're doing now is I'm up in Ohio and I'm looking for a permanent venue where we can just host once a month, twice a month, you know, whatever we want to do.
Nice. Cause you guys were traveling around the country for a while, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. We were moving all over the place.
Okay.
So
that was another part of it that gave me the TV show aspect.
You know,
these three guys that are this close going around doing this good mission, just traveling the country and just kicking it and having fun and helping people out. Even though it was just shot, it looks like, you know, on just cell phones or whatever, I was drawn in and I had to watch. Cause like I say, the connection that you all have, and then the purpose behind what you're doing, it's just a recipe for success to me. I mean, it just really, really drew me in. And I found myself watching all these videos. I'm like, okay, I need to get back to what I need.
Yeah. I appreciate it. Listen, if you know somebody in TV, I mean, we'll take some contracts, you know.
Absolutely, man. I will definitely keep the word out because I definitely think you guys got something there, man. No shit. I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. I really think you guys have something there. Even if you guys do it yourselves and make it a YouTube channel or something, you know, I really think you guys have something there. I mentioned in your introduction that you're also an author. And yes, I believe the new book is called The Thin Blue Ceiling. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Okay.
What made you write the book? What is it about?
Frustration. I think I'll tell you a story. I went to work one day and internal affairs showed up and said, you can't be here today. So we're going to walk you off. And wow. I thought, okay, this is, I've been with this agency for years, so I know how it works. First of all, you coming into my roll call to walk me out is not very common. You're doing that for a reason.
Right.
Right. I'm the example, I guess. You don't run your mouth or this is what'll happen. And so they put me on administrative leave and I thought, okay, so you're not going to promote me again. And this is, it's like right before promotions, I get, you know, walked out of there. And I thought, okay, we all know, everybody around knows I didn't do anything. So this is another one of those tactics. And I thought, all right, well, I have to have some get back. I can't just walk out of here. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to write a book and I'm going to expose some things. So the first thing that I did, the first chapter I wrote was, basically shaping my agency. This is the tactics that they use. This is what happens. And I wrote everybody's name in there. And then wow. I gave it to a buddy of mine. I go, hey, proofread this. And he sent it to him. Come on. I gave it to you, man. I said, just look at this. And he sent it to everybody. And you could download it from my website. You could download that first chapter for free.
Okay.
What I thought was like, oh, okay, I'll put it up there. It'll wet the whistle. People will see this book. And it just every day I would look up, download, download, download. Well, what happened with that was it was just people that worked with us. They're just nosy. They just thought, is this guy, the balls on this mother.
Yeah.
Like you're going to write everybody's name. I'm like, yeah, but this is what you did. It's not a story. These are facts.
Yeah.
So, when I went back, you know, I thought that wasn't the goal of the book, is just to tattletale and get back at everybody. And so what I wanted to write was, there's a chapter that's just got my story in it. There's a chapter that has the shape of the agency and how things work. There's a chapter on, how we, as law enforcement individuals, how do you negotiate a 20-year career? How do you get to retirement and keep your sanity? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not about fighting the administration. Cause like I say, I had a great part of my career. It was amazing. So it's not just about, oh, they're all against us. How do you fight back? But do you have a side business? Do you have some outside interests? Do you have some friends that do other things? And then, the last part of it was essentially, how do we repair a system that is, we all know if you work in it, that's broken, right? You have power, you have people at the head of that power table, and they essentially do what they want. And if you got a guy who's doing it great, you have a great agency. And if you know, the longer they're there, the more they think, well, I could just get away with whatever, your agency suffers. So how do we prevent against that? And so I just wanted to, I didn't want to have a book where I just was trash talking everybody. What I wanted to have is a desk reference. So for generations to come, you could pick that book up, read through it and get some information. Okay. I'm struggling with my finances. What do I do? There's answers in there for that.
Yeah. Now putting everybody's name in there, did you get any kind of pushback or repercussions or anything?
Everybody asks that. And no, like I mean, the truth of the matter is that it's all documented. Everything that was in there is documented. So it's not even he said, she said. It's not that. It is. I'm gone from the area. I don't live there anymore. And that just was a coincidence.
Yeah.
Two, the sheriff that, you know, I kind of had beef with was running an election and he wound up losing that election after I put that book out. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it or not, but now people's loyalties are shifting and a bunch of other things. I got a lot of calls from friends and old coworkers with the rah, rah, good job. And then, you know, the ones that didn't like me, I haven't seen, and they're not going to call and do anything.
Right.
And there's a big, the whole thread through that book is about cowardice. And, you know, a lot of these activities and actions that people put out, they're just basically cowardice. If you can't stand up for what's right, regardless of the outcome, mm-hmm. then why are you standing on the front line to protect everybody?
Absolutely.
And so you get a lot of that. And I hate to say it, but you get a lot of people that have something to say to me on the ill level, but they won't, you know, they're not going to say anything about it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Where can people get a copy of the book if they want to grab it?
That one's on my, it's on my website, humblenorthamerica.com. It's also on Amazon. So most people have an Amazon thing. It's on, ebook, and it's on a hard copy. You can get paperback as well.
Okay, guys, I'm going to put a link to that down in the show notes. So make sure you go over and check out The Thin Blue Ceiling. Ramsey, I want to go ahead and get into my, into what I call one of my, my segments here. And if you guys have listened to the podcast before, this is a new segment that I have implemented into the podcast, and it's called Life. And the reason why it's called Life is because these are a series of questions that all contain the word life in them. All right. So this is, it's a little self-reflecting time here. All right. So the first question is, what would you consider to be the most defining moment of your life thus far?
Wow. Okay. so many, but it's not even going to be law enforcement. I moved to California to go to college. I graduated college. I moved to San Diego. Anybody been to San Diego? Gorgeous. Sunny all the time. Everybody's 23. Beach everywhere, right? So I'm living in San Diego. I got two roommates from that I went to college with. We're out in the world. We're doing our thing. I was writing the first book I wrote. I was in the middle of writing that. And my mother lived in Michigan. She lived in Detroit.
Okay.
And she was going to go to Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, to teach, right? And so she flew down to San Diego. We're hanging out. She's going to say basically like a goodbye trip. I'm going to go over here and teach. I won't see you for a little bit. And building got blown up like in Kenya or somewhere. There was some terrorist attack. It might have been it wasn't the World Trade in 93. But anyway, something happened and my mother essentially got nervous. She got scared. She didn't want to go. Like, why would you? You go over into a middle of a war. And so she thought, ooh, let me rethink this. But she'd given up her house. She didn't have anywhere to go. So she stayed with me, and then she couldn't obviously stay in my apartment with my two roommates from college, because you know what that looks like.
Right.
So now she doesn't have a job, and she didn't have anywhere to go. And I didn't really have anything. I was 23 or whatever it was. And so I moved out of that beachfront apartment, and I moved into a little apartment sort of inland, cheaper, that I could afford. And that was the moment that I had to decide like what I was about, like how was I built? Mm-hmm. You know, here's my mother, who was my mother, right? Everybody, you love your mother. And she's sort of given everything up to go somewhere, and that plan didn't work. And so I realized, like, right, you got to get it right. I don't have time to be out here kicking it. And that sort of defined the rest of my adult life on how to, what my responsibilities were, who I valued in my life, and what I valued. And that's going to put me on this trajectory.
Awesome. Awesome. I love it. Love it. Next question. Are you living life to the fullest right now? If not, why not? If so, how so?
Yeah, I mean, I believe so. I think that, like, I talk a lot about being fearless, man. You, it's not about the win. It's only about the fight. Like, you can't just fight the fights you think are going to win.
Right.
You can't do that. You have to fight the ones that are necessary.
Yeah.
And so, like, I'm living proof. I tell people all the time, like, it cost me, you know, saying what I said at the agency. Well, I should have been a captain or a commander at this point, based on career, based on intellect, based on education. All my contemporaries are at that rank, but it cost me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I try to live my life the biggest I can. I would tell, you know, the kids, listen, the meaning of life is the biggest experiences and the biggest smiles without stepping on nobody.
Absolutely.
And that's it. And so, like, I think the answer to your why is, like all of us, I've been in car chases. I've been in car accidents. I've been shot at. I've had medical issues. And when you're faced with death for real, like for real, you realize eventually it's going to happen. And if I'm just hanging out these next 50 years scared of it, then I'm missing the point.
Yeah.
Missing the entire point. So I try to live it the biggest I can, the fullest I can. And I'm not really worried about the win. Just
absolutely. And if you just take on the wins, you know, and don't, and just, you take the easy route, there's no growth in it.
Yeah. Your record looks great.
Yeah.
50-0. Look at that. Undefeated. Like, you don't have any scars. You have no growth. You haven't done anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Next question. If you, and now pay attention to this one, people get tricked up on this one. If you had a friend who constantly spoke to you in the same manner that you sometimes speak to yourself, how long would that person remain in your life?
I mean, it sounds bad, but Yeah, I'm pretty good about talking to me.
Okay.
I'm pretty good about, I get your question and I think, yeah, forever. I believe in that positive self-speech. I believe in going at a pace, right? I talk all the time about timing. Mm-hmm. Like you got to do the things at the right time if you want them, you know, to come to fruition. So I'm pretty forgiving about what I need to do. I always said, listen, when I go to retirement, people ask, what are you going to do? You know, are you going to travel? Are you going to go play golf? I said, man, I'm going to take a nap for 2 months. Why are you so ambitious with, I'm not doing any of that stuff. I'm going to clean my house, do the laundry, and then I'm going to be asleep for 2 months. Right. And I think that, you wake up at 5 years old and you go to kindergarten and then it doesn't stop until you're retired. You go somewhere, absolutely, school, a job. So that reprogramming of your mind, it's a real thing. You think you can't just retire and then you're out here retired. You have to drift into that. And so yeah. I think I'm pretty good at understanding my limits, understanding what I'm supposed to do, understanding. I was telling my mom this the other day, that grind life. I don't get that. Like you every day, 4 o'clock in the morning, every day, it's too much. When it's time to grind, you need to be there. You need to be able to show up. You need to be ready. Yeah. But when it's time to relax, like what were you working so hard for?
Right.
So,
you know, it's that conversation we have between our ears sometimes, you know, it can do a lot to us. You know, I often use my sister-in-law as an example when I'm talking about this subject, because, you know, she's kind of going through that one of those things now. And, you know, I don't want to say she fell on some hard times. She wasn't where she thought she would be at in life at this point, you know.
Yeah.
And she finally got an opportunity to do something that she's always wanted to do. Well, she started getting cold feet and wanted to start having that self-doubt. Mm-hmm. And she calls my wife, and my wife just hands me the phone because she knows I'm going to give it to her straight.
You need that. You need that sometimes.
So yeah. she went ahead and she went through. She wanted to become a flight attendant.
Okay.
So she got an opportunity. I said, look, you need to have your ass on that plane come Monday morning and head to that training, which she did. So she calls a couple of days ago and she's talking to my wife and she says, I'm having second thoughts about this. And I said, give me the phone. The problem is, you're out of your comfort zone and you don't know how to deal with it. You know, I said, it's good to get out of that comfort zone because it's only 6 weeks of your life. Think about what's going to happen at the end of those 6 weeks, how different your life will be. But think about if you quit now, what your life will be, not just 6 weeks from now, but a year from now. Because if you don't take this opportunity to change now, you're never going to change. You're 50 some years old. This is your last opportunity.
Right.
And for the most part, the field that you're trying to go into, you know, so that conversation we have up here, man, it can make a breaker sometimes, you know.
I ask this question. Number one, I don't think any of us are where we thought we were going to be if you asked us at 8 or 10 or 15.
Yeah.
None of us are. But the question is this, are you happy?
Yeah.
Like I didn't want a lot of the pieces that happened in my life, but every day I wake up and think, okay, but I'm cool. I'm great.
Yeah. Well, that leads me to my next question. And that is, if I came to you 5 years from now, and I said, Ramsey, how is everything going? And you said, man, everything is fantastic. What does that look like?
Huh. I don't think it's in the details. I mean, I think that, you know, when we're younger, we go, oh, I got married. I had 2 kids. I got this Maserati. I'm out here winning. I think that when I was younger, the girls would ask, yeah, you want to get married? And I would say, well, that's not the goal. The goal is to be happy. So if I'm with you and I'm married, I'm happy. If I'm with you and I'm not, I'm going to be happy regardless. So today's plan is, I have this great venue. I have people coming in. I can really, you know, hit the nonprofits. I can really dig deep and give back to the community and participate. Maybe I finish a couple other books. I'm out there selling them. This is amazing. Can I live on this boat and go surf every day and eat fish tacos? That would be great. And that's today's plan. And in 5 years, if you show up and you ask me that same question and it looks different, I guarantee you it looks different because I controlled it into that way as well.
Yeah.
So I'm good, whatever.
Yeah, man. I that's something I like to ask people because I think a lot of people don't think about that far ahead because we're all so stuck in today and how we're going to get through the day that, you know, we don't think that far out. And what if, what can be, you know, because we're so, a lot of people nowadays, you know, we're caught up in the here and now. And I encourage everybody that's listening to this, take 5 minutes and just think about the next 5 years. What does that look like for you? Where will you be? You know, what's going to be, will things be different? Will they be the same? You know, that's something you obviously have to answer, but just take time to at least think about it. Last question here, Mel.
Yeah.
Who has had the greatest impact on your life?
A lot of people, man. I would, this is kind of backwards, but I would say my father.
Okay.
And my father taught me what not to do. Like he was a great example of, man, I would never do that. You know, he left when I was probably three.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get older and I'm like, bro, it wasn't that hard.
Yeah.
You know, whatever you ran from, it wasn't that hard. And I, you know, I went back when I was 18 and I went back when I was 20 and I went back when I was 18 on purpose. Like I'm grown. I'm not here for child support. I'm just offering you an opening into this life. And he didn't take it. You know, he had a store that he owned. I went in there and he basically kicked me out. And then when I was 20, I went in there with a buddy of mine and he kicked me out. And we never talked about it until I was about 35. And my buddy goes, I never thought anybody could have a worse father than mine, you know, but he taught me to value other things. And I think you can learn a lot from absence, you know, and he just died a few years ago. And it's like, the biggest pain was that I didn't have any pain. Like that was it's weird not to have a feeling your father passes on it. Like, good for you, man.
I understand what you mean. Cause my dad had this split personality when he was an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And when he didn't drink, he was the best father on the planet. He taught me a lot. The minute he got a bottle in his hand, like you said, he taught me a lot of things that I didn't want to do.
Right. You know?
And there was a lot of, you know, domestic in the house when we were younger, and it all stemmed from him drinking, you know, and to this day, I always tell my wife, that's why I don't argue. You know, because I saw the outcome and what it did. And I have those memories, and I never wanted my kids to have those types of memories of their parents carrying on the way my parents did, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know, man, it's interesting. I mean, you know, my dad passed away actually 2 days before I started the academy. And, it's interesting. You know, he could have been a really good man had he not turned to that bottle. That bottle really destroyed him.
Yeah. It's hard. I think a lot of people, I am self-made, 100% self-made. I got nothing from nobody. I paid for college to go, you know, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that who knows what would have happened if my specific father was in there or if I had a, you know, father figure, I'd better or worse. I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
But everything that I've done and everything that I've built and everything that I value is out of desperation, and it's out of, you know, wishing that he was there when he wasn't. And it's out of emulating, you know, from afar. Oh, he's got his own business. It's out of, I'd never want to punch my lady. This guy, why would you do that? You know?
Yeah.
And so he's had a very profound effect on me. He's who I gauge myself against, you know, all sorts of things. And I think that typically the answer is, oh, it was my football coach. He taught me how to be a man. And it's like, yeah, there were a lot of those though. A lot of guys showed up.
TV.
Bill Cosby before all the court stuff, it's the Cosby Show. He teach you, this is what kind of father I want to be. There's a ton of people that, you know, put in on me, but the most profound change in me was the person that put nothing in.
Wow. All right, man. I want to go ahead and get into my last segment here. And this is my rapid fire round. This is what I call this or that. I'm simply going to give you two topics. You don't have to give it too much thought. Don't have to necessarily explain why. Just pick one or the other.
Okay.
All right. And the first one is night shift or day shift?
Oh, night shift. All day.
Ride single or have a partner?
Oh, single.
I think I already know the answer to this next one. Soak up the overtime or not unless they force me?
Oh, no. If they force me, I'm not. I'd rather spend less money. I'm cool. I don't need a Rolex. I'm good. I'd rather be at home.
And Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts?
Oh, neither, but whoever got the best hot chocolate. I'm not a coffee guy.
I saw that in one of the videos. You guys are going to Starbucks or something.
Oh, yeah. No coffee.
Get involved off duty or make a good witness.
Oh, get involved all day.
FNG as a partner or the salty old vet. And again, for those that don't know what FNG is, that's the fucking new guy.
Yeah, it depends on which. I'll take the old. I got some old good partners. I like the old guy.
Okay. And direct traffic in 20 degree or 90 degree weather?
Oh, 90. I'm from California. 20. No, we don't see that. 90.
Cops or live PD?
Oh, cops. I was on Cops twice.
Were you?
Yeah.
Okay. Nice. Two more here. Donuts, filling or no filling?
Filling, man. Cream filling.
And the last one, honesty or respect?
Honesty.
Yeah. I don't know. For me, I think it's respect. Because if you lie to me, then obviously you don't respect me.
100%. I think, and that's probably the deeper question. The other ones are kind of fun. But I feel like if I'm honest to you, you ain't got no choice but to respect it. You may not like me, but you respect me. And I feel like in my career and in my life, I've stood up a lot. And what I've heard in response was, yeah, I don't like that guy. And the next guy goes, yeah, well, he's right, though. I mean, you know, and you can be honest with decorum as well. You don't just got to be an idiot about it. You can have some tact. You know, like I was a negotiator for 10 years on our team, so I should know how to talk.
Yeah, I was a negotiator also, and I hear what you're saying. Yeah, for sure, man. But good point. You know, I if you are honest with somebody, then that does show a level of respect.
Yeah,
and like you say, you don't have to like me, but that's cool. But if you're straight with me, then we know where each other comes from.
For sure.
So I can definitely deal with that. Ramsey, man, listen, this was fun. I enjoyed it, man. I appreciate having the pleasure to speak with you. Before we get out of here, can you do me a favor? Can you share your social media? I know you had given it earlier, but can you, if you don't mind, can you share one more time?
Yeah, not a problem. We have humblenorthamerica.com is our website. And we have two Instagrams, Humble Kitchen 2019 and Humble North America, and both on Instagram. And I think there's a Humble North America Facebook page as well.
Awesome. And guys, like I said, there's going to be links to all of that down in the show notes. So please go over, check out Ramsey, check out the videos and everything that they're doing with the Humble Kitchen. Check out the book. All that is going to be linked down in the show notes. Any last words before we get out of here?
No, I appreciate you having me. It's always good to be able to connect, you say, off duty with people. And given that you're from the Detroit area, that was a great shock for me.
So yeah,
I see the 248 was like, oh, all right.
Yeah, I actually worked in Southfield. You know, I spent 20 years in Southfield. I grew up there, and you know, my wife and I, we had moved after the kids came. We had moved out to the rural area, and once the kids left, we came back to the city area and everything. And here we are, man. You know, good old Detroit. You know, it's the city has changed. I don't know when the last time you've been here, but the city has changed so much. It's a city now, you know.
Yeah.
You go downtown, it looks like a city now.
Yeah, I was just telling somebody about Detroit a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, yeah, the last time I was there for real was probably 7 years ago. And I'm like, okay. You never seen a ghost town? Like you never seen a modern ghost town where I was going down streets looking in houses that were abandoned, and they still had food in the cabinet. It's like they just left. How do you do that?
You're talking about gentrification at its finest.
Yeah. It's like, all right, well, we're going to be up there in March, so we'll have to check it out.
Yeah, definitely go downtown, man. You won't even recognize it. It actually looks like a city. It's fun. Just quick story. There used to be a condo complex across the street from Little Caesars Arena, and they were built back in 91, 92. Mm-hmm. And I remember when they built them, I'm like, who in the hell would buy these? There's nothing here. Yeah, think at the time they were probably $70,000, $80,000, something like that. Now they're worth, I want to say $500,000,
$600,000. Yeah. I looked at some of those and was like, wow, Detroit. Okay. If that's what you say.
Yeah. Well, Ramsey, sir, again, I appreciate you taking time out of your day, man, to jump on here with me. I'm sorry for all the technical issues we had here at the beginning. Hopefully everything turned out fine when I go back to listen to the recording. To you, the listener, I appreciate you tuning in each and every episode and listening to the podcast. If you guys want to support The best way you can support is please follow on whatever platform it is that you listen to your podcasts on. That's the best way you can help the show out, that and share it with somebody else. You guys stay safe. I appreciate you all, and I will catch you guys on the next episode. I'm out of here. Bye-bye.